my skin, and the sour whiff of antiseptic and infection rising from my bandaged abdomen. "Hooray!" I said. "More climbing." This time, Reyna took the lead. There was no climbing cage going to the second level, just bare metal rungs against the side of the girder. As if the builders had decided, "Welp, if you made it this far, you must be crazy. So no more safety features." Now that the metal-ribbed chute was gone, I realized it had given me some psychological comfort. At least I could pretend I was inside a safe structure, not free-climbing a giant tower like a lunatic. It made no sense to me why Tarquin would put something as important as his silent god at the top of a radio tower, or why he had allied himself with the emperors in the first place, or why the smell of roses might signal that we were getting closer to our goal, or why those dark birds kept circling above us in the fog. Weren't they cold? Didn't they have jobs? Still, I had no doubt we were meant to climb this monstrous tripod. It felt right, by which I mean it felt terrifying and wrong. I had a premonition that everything would make sense to me soon enough. And when it did, I wouldn't like it. It was as if I were standing in the dark, staring at small disconnected lights in the distance, wondering what they might be. By the time I realized, "Oh, hey, those are the headlights of a large truck barreling toward me," it would be too late. We were halfway to the second set of crossbeams when an angry shadow dove out of the fog, plummeting past my shoulder. The gust from its wings nearly knocked me off the ladder. "Whoa!" Meg grabbed my left ankle, though that did nothing to steady me. "What was that?" I caught a glimpse of the bird as it disappeared back into the fog. Oily black wings, black beak, black eyes. A sob built in my throat as one of the proverbial truck's headlights became very clear to me. "A raven." "A raven?" Reyna frowned down at me. "That thing was huge." "True. The creature that buzzed me must have had a wingspan of at least 20 feet. But then several angry croaks sounded from somewhere in the mist, leaving me in no doubt. "Ravens, plural," I corrected. "Giant ravens." Half a dozen spiraled into view, their hungry black eyes dancing over us like targeting lasers, assessing our soft and tasty weak spots. "A flock of ravens?" Meg sounded half incredulous, half fascinated. "Those are the guards? They're pretty." I groaned, wishing I could be anywhere else. Like in bed, under a thick layer of warm Kevlar quilts. I was tempted to protest that a group of ravens was actually called an unkindness or a conspiracy. I wanted to shout that Tarquin's guards should be disqualified on that technicality. But I doubted Tarquin cared about such niceties. I knew the ravens didn't. They would kill us either way, no matter how pretty Meg thought they were. Besides, calling ravens unkind and conspiratorial had always seemed redundant to me. "They're here because of Coronis," I said miserably. "This is my fault." "Who's Coronis?" Reyna demanded. "Long story." I yelled at the birds. "Guys, I've apologized a million times." The ravens croaked back angrily. A dozen more dropped out of the fog and began to circle us. "They'll tear us apart," I said. "We have to retreat, back to the first platform." "The second platform is closer," Reyna said. "Keep climbing."
"Maybe they're just checking us out," Meg said. "Maybe they won't attack."
She shouldn't have said that.
Ravens are contrary creatures. I should know. I shaped them into what they are.
As soon as Meg expressed the hope that they wouldn't attack, They did.
Chapter 26. I'd like to sing a classic for you now, thank you. Please stop stabbing me. In retrospect, I should have given ravens sponges for beaks. Nice, soft, squishy sponges that weren't capable of stabbing. While I was at it, I should have thrown in some Nerf claws. But no. I let them have beaks like serrated knives and claws like meat hooks. What had I been thinking? Meg yelled as one of the birds dove by her, raking her arm. Another flew at Raina's legs. The praetor leveled a kick at it, but her heel missed the bird and connected with my nose. "Owie!" I yelled, my whole face throbbing. "My bad!" Raina tried to climb, but the birds swirled around us, stabbing and clawing and tearing away bits of our clothes. The frenzy reminded me of my farewell concert in Thessalonica back in 235 BC. I like to do a farewell tour every 10 years or so, just to keep the fans guessing. Dionysus had shown up with his entire horde of souvenir-hunting maenads. Not a good memory. "Lester, who is Coronis?" Raina shouted, drawing her sword. "Why were you apologizing to the birds?"
"I created them."
My busted nose made me sound like I was gargling syrup. The ravens cawed in outrage. One swooped, its claws narrowly missing my left eye. Raina swung her sword wildly, trying to keep the flock at bay.
"Well, can you uncreate them?"
Meg asked. The ravens didn't like that idea. One dove at Meg. She tossed it a seed, which, being a raven, it instinctively snapped out of the air. A pumpkin exploded to full growth in its beak. The raven, suddenly top-heavy with a mouthful of Halloween, plummeted toward the ground.
"Okay, I didn't exactly create them,"
I confessed. "I just changed them into what they are now. And no, I can't undo it." More angry cries from the birds, though for the moment they stayed away, wary of the girl with the sword and the other one with the tasty exploding seeds. Tarquin had chosen the perfect guards to keep me from his silent god. Ravens hated me. They probably worked for free, without even a health plan, just hoping to have the chance to bring me down. I suspected the only reason we were still alive was that the birds were trying to decide who got the honor of the kill. Each angry croak was a claim to my tasty bits.
"I get his liver."
"No, I get his liver."
"Well, I get his kidneys then."
Ravens are as greedy as they are contrary. Alas, we couldn't count on them arguing with one another for long. We'd be dead as soon as they figured out their proper pecking order. Oh, maybe that's why they call it a pecking order. Raina took a swipe at one that was getting too close. She glanced at the catwalk on the crossbeam above us, perhaps calculating whether she'd have time to reach it if she sheathed her sword. Judging from her frustrated expression, her conclusion was no.
"Lester, I need intel," she said. "Tell me how we defeat these things."
"I don't know,"
I wailed. "Look, back in the old days, ravens used to be gentle and white, like doves, okay? But they were terrible gossips. One time I was dating this girl, Coronis. The ravens found out she was cheating on me, and they told me about it. I was so angry I got Artemis to kill Coronis for me. Then I punished the ravens for being tattletales by turning them black." Raina stared at me like she was contemplating another kick to my nose. "That story is messed up on so many levels."
"Just wrong," Meg agreed. "You had your sister kill a girl who was cheating on you?"
"Well, I..."
"Then you punished the birds that told you about it," Raina added, "by turning them black. As if black was bad and white was good."
"When you put it that way, it doesn't sound right," I protested.
"It's just what happened when my curse scorched them. It also made them nasty-tempered flesh-eaters."
Oh, that's much better, Raina snarled. If we let the birds eat you, Meg asked, will they leave Raina and me alone? What?
I worried that Meg might not be kidding. Her facial expression did not say kidding. It said serious about the birds eating you.
Listen, I was angry. Yes, I took it out on the birds, but after a few centuries, I cooled down. I apologized. By then, they kind of liked being nasty-tempered flesh eaters. As for Coronis, I mean, at least I saved the child she was pregnant with when Artemis killed her. He became Asclepius, god of medicine.
Your girlfriend was pregnant when you had her killed. Raina launched another kick at my face. I managed to dodge it, since I'd had a lot of practice cowering, but it hurt to know that this time she hadn't been aiming at an incoming raven. Oh no, she wanted to knock my teeth in.
You suck, Meg agreed.
Can we talk about this later? I pleaded. Or perhaps never. I was a god then. I didn't know what I was doing. A few months ago, a statement like that would have made no sense to me. Now it seemed true. I felt as if Meg had given me her thick-lensed, rhinestone-studded glasses, and to my horror, they corrected my eyesight. I didn't like how small and tawdry and petty everything looked, rendered in perfect, ugly clarity through the magic of Megovision. Most of all, I didn't like the way I looked. Not just present-day Lester, but the god formerly known as Apollo. Raina exchanged glances with Meg. They seemed to reach a silent agreement that the most practical course of action would be to survive the ravens now so they could kill me themselves later.
We're dead if we stay here. Raina swung her sword at another enthusiastic flesh eater. We can't fend them off and climb at the same time. Ideas?
The ravens had one. It was called all-out attack. They swarmed, pecking, scratching, croaking with rage.
I'm sorry, I screamed, futilely swatting at the birds. I'm sorry.
The ravens did not accept my apology. Claws ripped my pant legs. A beak clamped onto my quiver and almost pulled me off the ladder, leaving my feet dangling for a terrifying moment. Raina continued to slash away. Meg cursed and threw seeds like party favors from the worst parade float ever. A giant raven spiraled out of control, covered in daffodils. Another fell like a stone, its stomach bulging in the shape of a butternut squash. My grip weakened on the rungs. Blood dripped from my nose, but I couldn't spare a moment to wipe it away. Raina was right. If we didn't move, we were dead. And we couldn't move. I scanned the crossbeam above us. If we could just reach it, we'd be able to stand and use our arms. We'd have a fighting chance to, well, fight. At the far end of the catwalk, abutting the next support pylon, stood a large rectangular box, like a shipping container. I was surprised I hadn't noticed it sooner, but compared to the scale of the tower, the container seemed small and insignificant, just another wedge of red metal. I had no idea what such a box was doing up here. A maintenance depot? A storage shed? But if we could find a way inside, it might offer us shelter.
Over there, I yelled.
Raina followed my gaze.
If we can reach it, we need to buy time. Apollo, what repels ravens? Isn't there something they hate?
Worse than me?
They don't like daffodils much,
Meg observed, as another flower-festooned bird went into a tailspin.
We need something to drive them all away, Raina said, swinging her sword again. Something they'll hate worse than Apollo.
Her eyes lit up.
Apollo, sing for them.
She might as well have kicked me in the face again.
My voice isn't that bad. But you're the...
You used to be the god of music, right? If you can charm a crowd, you should be able to repulse one. Pick a song these birds will hate.
Great.
Not only had Reyna laughed in my face and busted my nose, now I was her go-to guy for repulsiveness.
Still, I was struck by the way she said, I used to be a god.
She didn't seem to mean it as an insult.
She said it almost like a concession, like she knew what a horrible deity I had been, but held out hope that I might be capable of being someone better, more helpful, maybe even worthy of forgiveness.
Okay, I said. Okay, let me think.
The ravens had no intention of letting me do that. They cawed and swarmed in a flurry of black feathers and pointy talons.
Reyna and Meg tried their best to drive them back,
but they couldn't cover me completely. A beak stabbed me in the neck, narrowly missing my carotid artery. Claws raked the side of my face, no doubt giving me some bloody new racing stripes. I couldn't think about the pain. I wanted to sing for Reyna, to prove that I had indeed changed. I was no longer the god who'd had Coronis killed and created ravens, or cursed the Cumaean Sibyl, or done any of the other selfish things that had once given me no more pause than choosing what dessert toppings I wanted on my ambrosia. It was time to be helpful. I needed to be repulsive for my friends. I rifled through millennia of performance memories, trying to recall any of my musical numbers that had totally bombed. Nope, I couldn't think of any. And the birds kept attacking. Birds attacking. An idea sparked at the base of my skull. I remembered a story my children, Austin and Kayla, had told me, back when I was at Camp Half-Blood. We were sitting at the campfire, and they'd been joking about Chiron's bad taste in music. They said that several years earlier, Percy Jackson had managed to drive off a flock of killer Stymphalian birds simply by playing what Chiron had on his boombox. What had he played? What was Chiron's favorite? Valare! I screamed. Meg looked up at me, a random geranium stuck in her hair.
Who?
It's a song Dean Martin covered, I said. It might be unacceptable to birds. I'm not sure.
Well, be sure, Reyna yelled. Ravens furiously scratched and pecked at her cloak, unable to tear the magical fabric, but her front side was unprotected. Every time she swung her sword, a bird swooped in, stabbing at her exposed chest and arms. Her long-sleeved tee was quickly turning into a short-sleeved tee. I channeled my worst King of Cool. I imagined I was on a Las Vegas stage, a line of empty martini glasses on the piano behind me. I was wearing a velvet tuxedo. I had just smoked a pack of cigarettes. In front of me sat a crowd full of adoring, tone-deaf fans.
Volare!
I cried, modulating my voice to add about 20 syllables to the word.
Whoa! Oh!
The response from the ravens was immediate. They recoiled as if we'd suddenly become vegetarian entrees. Some threw themselves bodily against the metal girders, making the whole tower shudder.
Keep going, Meg yelled.
Phrased as an order, her words forced me to comply. With apologies to Domenico Modugno, who wrote the song, I gave Volare the full Dean Martin treatment. It had once been such a lovely, obscure little tune. Originally, Modugno called it Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu, which, granted, was a bad title. I don't know why artists insist on doing that. Like the Wallflowers' One Headlight, obviously should have been titled Me and Cinderella. And Ed Sheeran's The A-Team should clearly have been called Too Cold for Angels to Fly. I mean, come on, guys, you're burying the lead. At any rate, Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu
might have faded into obscurity had Dean Martin not gotten a hold of it, repackaged it as Volare, added 7,000 violins and backup singers, and turned it into a sleazy lounge singer classic. I didn't have backup singers. All I had was my voice. But I did my best to be terrible. Even when I was a god and could speak any language I wanted, I'd never sung well in Italian. I kept mixing it up with Latin, so I came off sounding like Julius Caesar with a head cold. My newly busted nose just added to the awfulness. I bellowed and warbled, screwing my eyes shut and clinging to the ladder as ravens flapped around me, croaking in horror at my travesty of a song. Far below, Reyna's greyhounds bayed as if they'd lost their mothers. I became so engrossed in murdering Volare, I didn't notice that the ravens had gone silent until Meg shouted,
"Apollo, enough!"
I faltered halfway through a chorus. When I opened my eyes, the ravens were nowhere in sight. From somewhere in the fog, their indignant caws grew fainter and fainter as the flock moved off in search of quieter, less revolting prey. "My ears," Reyna complained. "Oh, gods, my ears will never heal." "The ravens will be back," I warned. My throat felt like the chute of a cement mixer. "As soon as they manage to purchase enough raven-sized noise-canceling headphones, they'll be back. Now climb. I don't have another Dean Martin song in me." Chapter 27. Let's play Guess the God. Starts with H, wants to kill me. Besides my stepmom. As soon as I reached the catwalk, I gripped the rail. I wasn't sure if my legs were wobbly or if the entire tower was swaying. I felt like I was back on Poseidon's pleasure trireme, the one pulled by blue whales.
"Oh, it's a smooth ride," he'd promised. "You'll love it."
Below, San Francisco stretched out in a rumpled quilt of green and gray, the edges frayed with fog. I felt a twinge of nostalgia for my days on the Sun Chariot. Oh, San Francisco. Whenever I saw that beautiful city below, I knew my day's journey was almost done. I could finally park my chariot at the Palace of the Sun, relax for the night, and let whatever other forces that controlled night and day take over for me. "Sorry, Hawaii. I love you, but I wasn't about to work overtime to give you a sunrise." The ravens were nowhere in sight. That didn't mean anything. A blanket of fog still obscured the top of the tower. The killers might swoop out of it at any minute. It wasn't fair that birds with 20-foot wingspans could sneak up on us so easily. At the far end of the catwalk sat the shipping container. The scent of roses was so strong now even I could smell it, and it seemed to be coming from the box. I took a step toward it and immediately stumbled. "Careful." Reyna grabbed my arm. A jolt of energy went through me, steadying my legs. Perhaps I imagined it. Or maybe I was just shocked that she had made physical contact with me, and it did not involve placing her boot in my face. "I'm okay," I said. One godly skill had not abandoned me. Lying. "You need medical attention," Reyna said. "Your face is a horror show." "Thanks."
"I've got supplies," Meg announced.
She rummaged through the pouches of her gardening belt. I was terrified she might try to patch my face with flowering bougainvillea, but instead she pulled out tape, gauze, and alcohol wipes. I supposed her time with Prangel had taught her more than just how to use a cheese grater. She fussed over my face, then checked me and Reyna for any especially deep cuts and punctures. We had plenty. Soon all three of us looked like refugees from George Washington's camp at Valley Forge. We could have spent the whole afternoon bandaging each other, but we didn't have that much time. Meg turned to regard the shipping container. She still had a stubborn geranium stuck in her hair. Her tattered dress rippled around her like shreds of seaweed.
What is that thing? She wondered. What's it doing up here? And why does it smell like roses?
Good questions. Judging scale and distance on the tower was difficult. Tucked against the girders, the shipping container looked close and small. But it was probably a full city block away from us, and larger than Marlon Brando's personal trailer on the set of The Godfather.
Wow. Where did that memory come from? Crazy times.
Installing that huge red box on Sutro Tower would have been a massive undertaking. Then again, the triumvirate had enough cash to purchase 50 luxury yachts, so they could probably afford a few cargo helicopters. The bigger question was, why? From the sides of the container, glimmering bronze and gold cables snaked outward, weaving around the pylon and crossbeams like grounding wires, connecting to satellite dishes, cellular arrays, and power boxes. Was there some sort of monitoring station inside? The world's most expensive hothouse for roses? Or perhaps the most elaborate scheme ever to steal premium cable TV channels? The closest end of the box was fitted with cargo doors, the vertical locking rods laced with rows of heavy chains. Whatever was inside was meant to stay there.
Any ideas? Raina asked.
Try to get inside that container, I said. It's a terrible idea, but it's the only one I have.
Yeah.
Raina scanned the fog over our heads. Let's move before the ravens come back for an encore. Meg summoned her swords. She led the way across the catwalk, but after 20 feet or so, she stopped abruptly, as if she'd run into an invisible wall. She turned to face us.
Guys, is me or feel weird?
I thought the kick to my face might have short-circuited my brain.
What, Meg? I said wrong, like cold and...
I glanced at Raina. Did you hear that? Only half of her words are coming through. Why aren't our voices affected? I studied the short expanse of catwalk separating us from Meg. An unpleasant suspicion wriggled in my head.
Meg, take a step back toward me, please. Why? Want? Just humor me.
She did.
So are you guys feeling weird too? Like, kind of cold?
She frowned.
Wait, it's better now.
You were dropping words, Raina said.
I was?
The girls looked at me for an explanation.
Sadly, I thought I might have one,
or at least the beginnings of one. The metaphorical truck with the metaphorical headlights was getting closer to metaphorically running me over.
You two wait here for a second, I said. I want to try something.
I took a few steps toward the shipping container. When I reached the spot where Meg had been standing, I felt the difference, as if I'd stepped across the threshold of a walk-in freezer. Another 10 feet, and I couldn't hear the wind anymore, or the pinging of metal cables against the sides of the tower, or the blood rushing in my ears. I snapped my fingers. No sound. Panic rose in my chest. Complete silence. A music god's worst nightmare. I faced Raina and Meg. I tried to shout, "Can you hear me now?"
Nothing.
My vocal cords vibrated, but the sound waves seemed to die before they left my mouth. Meg said something I couldn't hear. Raina spread her arms. I gestured for them to wait. Then I took a deep breath and forced myself to keep going toward the box. I stopped within an arm's length of the cargo doors. The rose bouquet smell was definitely coming from inside. The chains across the locking rods were heavy imperial gold. Enough rare, magical metal to buy a decent-sized palace on Mount Olympus. Even in my mortal form, I could feel the power radiating from the container. Not just the heavy silence, but the cold, needling aura of wards and curses placed on the metal doors and walls to keep us out, to keep something in. On the left-hand door, stenciled in white paint, was a single word in Arabic. My Arabic was even rustier than my Dean Martin Italian, but I was fairly sure it was the name of a city. Alexandria. As in Alexandria, Egypt. My knees almost buckled. My vision swam. I might have sobbed, though I couldn't hear it. Slowly, gripping the rail for support, I staggered back to my friends. I only knew I'd left the zone of silence when I could hear myself muttering, "No, no, no, no." Meg caught me before I could fall over.
"What's wrong? What happened?"
"I think I understand," I said. "The soundless god." "Who is it?" Raina asked. "I don't know." Raina blinked. "But you just said, I think I understand. Remembering who it is exactly, that's harder. I'm pretty sure we're dealing with a Ptolemaic god, from back in the days when the Greeks ruled Egypt." Meg looked past me at the container.
"So there's a god in the box."
I shuddered, remembering the short-lived fast food franchise Hermes had once tried to open on Mount Olympus. Thankfully, God in the Box never took off. "Yes, Meg. A very minor Egyptian-Greek hybrid god, I think, which is most likely why he couldn't be found in the Camp Jupiter archives." "If he's so minor," Raina said, "why do you look so scared?" A bit of my old Olympian haughtiness surged through me. Mortals. They could never understand. "Ptolemaic gods are awful," I said. "They are unpredictable, temperamental, dangerous, insecure."
"Like a normal god, then," Meg said.
"I hate you," I said.
"I thought you loved me."
"I'm multitasking." Roses were this god's symbol. I don't remember why. A connection to Venus? He was in charge of secrets. In the old days, if leaders hung a rose from the ceiling of a conference room, it meant everybody in that conversation was sworn to secrecy. They called it sub rosa, under the rose. "So you know all that," Raina said, "but you don't know the god's name."
He's...
A frustrated growl rose from my throat.
"I almost have it. I should have it. But I haven't thought about this god in millennia. He's very obscure. It's like asking me to remember the name of a particular backup singer I worked with during the Renaissance. Perhaps if you hadn't kicked me in the head after that story about Coronis," Raina said,
"you deserved it."
"You did,"
Meg agreed. I sighed. "You two are horrible influences on each other." Without taking their eyes off me, Raina and Meg gave each other a silent high five. "Fine," I grumbled. "Maybe the arrow of Dodona can help jog my memory. At least he insults me in flowery Shakespearean language." I drew the arrow from my quiver. "Oh, prophetic missile, I need your guidance." There was no answer. I wondered if the arrow had been lulled to sleep by the magic surrounding the storage container. Then I realized there was a simpler explanation. I returned the arrow to my quiver and pulled out a different one.
"You chose the wrong arrow, didn't you?" Meg gasped.
"No," I snapped. "You just don't understand my process. I'm going back into the sphere of silence now."
"But..."
I marched away before Meg could finish. Only when I was surrounded by cold silence again did it occur to me that it might be hard to carry on a conversation with the arrow if I couldn't talk. No matter. I was too proud to retreat. If the arrow and I couldn't communicate telepathically, I would just pretend to have an intelligent conversation while Reyna and Meg looked on. Oh, prophetic missile! I tried again. My vocal cords vibrated, though no sound came out. A disturbing sensation I can only compare to drowning. I need your guidance.
Congratulations, said the arrow.
Its voice resonated in my head, more tactile than audible, rattling my eyeballs. Thanks, I said. Wait, congratulations for what?
Thou hast found thy groove. At least the beginnings of thy groove. I suspected this would be so, given time. Congratulations are merited.
Oh. I stared at the arrow's point, waiting for a but. None came. I was so surprised I could only stutter. Thanks.
Thou art most welcome.
Did we just have a polite exchange?
Aye,
the arrow mused.
Most troubling. By the by, what process wert thou speaking of to yon maidens? Thou hast no process save fumbling.
Here we go, I muttered. Please, my memory needs a jump start. This soundless god, he's that guy from Egypt, isn't he?
Well reasoned, sirrah, the arrow said. Thou hast narrowed it down to all the guys in Egypt.
You know what I mean. There was that one Ptolemaic god. The strange dude, he was a god of silence and secrets. But he wasn't exactly. If you can just give me his name, I think the rest of my memories will shake loose.
Is my wisdom so cheaply bought? Dost thou expect to win his name with no effort?
What do you call climbing Sutro Tower? I demanded. Getting slashed to pieces by ravens, kicked in the face, and forced to sing like Dean Martin.
Amusing.
I may have yelled a few choice words, but the sphere of silence censored them, so you will have to use your imagination. Fine, I said. Can you at least give me a hint?
Verily, the name doth begin with an H.
Hephaestus, Hermes, Hera, a lot of gods' names begin with H.
Hera, art thou serious?
I'm just brainstorming. H, you say.
Think of thy favorite physician.
Me. Wait, my son Asclepius. The arrow's sigh rattled my entire skeleton.
Your favorite mortal physician.
Dr. Kildare, Dr. Doom, Dr. House, Dr. Oh, you mean Hippocrates. But he's not a Ptolemaic god.
Thou art killing me,
the arrow complained.
Hippocrates is thy hint. The name thou seekest is most like it. Thou needest but change two letters.
Which two? I felt petulant, but I'd never enjoyed word puzzles, even before my horrific experience in the burning maze.
I shall give thee one last hint, said the arrow. Think of thy favorite Marx brother.
The Marx brothers? How do you even know about them? They were from the 1930s. I mean, yes, of course, I loved them. They brightened a dreary decade, but... Wait. The one who played the harp. Harpo. I always found his music sweet and sad and... The silence turned colder and heavier around me. Harpo, I thought. Hippocrates. Put the names together and you got... Harpocrates, I said. Arrow, please tell me that's not the answer.
Please tell me he's not waiting in that box.
The arrow did not reply,
which I took as confirmation of my worst fears.
I returned my Shakespearean friend to his quiver and trudged back to Raina and Meg. Meg frowned.
I don't like that look on your face.
Me neither, Raina said. What did you learn? I gazed out at the fog, wishing we could deal with something as easy as killer giant ravens.
As I suspected, the name of the god had shaken loose my memories. Bad, unwelcome memories.
I know which god we face, I said. The good news is he's not very powerful, as gods go. About as obscure as you can imagine. A real D-lister.
Raina folded her arms. What's the catch?
Well,
I cleared my throat.
Harpocrates and I didn't exactly get along. He might have, sworn that someday he'd see me vaporized.
Chapter 28. We all need a hand. On our shoulder, sometimes so. We can chew through steel.
Vaporized, said Raina.
Yes. What did you do to him? Meg asked.
I tried to look offended.
Nothing.
I may have teased him a bit, but he was a very minor god. Rather silly looking.
I may have made some jokes at his expense in front of the other Olympians.
Raina knit her eyebrows. So you bullied him?
No! I mean, I did write Zap Me in glowing letters on the back of his toga, and I suppose I might have been a bit harsh when I tied him up and locked him in the stalls with my fiery horses overnight.
Oh, my gods, Meg said. You're awful.
I fought down the urge to defend myself. I wanted to shout, well, at least I didn't kill him like I did my pregnant girlfriend, Coronis. But that wasn't much of a gotcha.
Looking back on my encounters with Harpocrates, I realized I had been awful. If somebody had treated me, Lester, the way I had treated that puny Ptolemaic god, I would want to crawl in a hole and die. And if I were honest, even back when I was a god, I had been bullied, only the bully had been my father. I should have known better than to share the pain.
I hadn't thought about Harpocrates in eons. Teasing him had seemed like no big deal.
I suppose that's what made it even worse. I had shrugged off our encounters. I doubted he had.
Coronis's ravens, Harpocrates. It was no coincidence they were both haunting me today, like the ghosts of Saturnalia's past.
Tarquin had orchestrated all this with me in mind. He was forcing me to confront some of my greatest hits of dreadfulness. Even if I survived the challenges, my friends would see exactly what kind of dirtbag I was. The shame would weigh me down and make me ineffective. The same way Tarquin used to add rocks to a cage around his enemy's head, until eventually the burden was too much. The prisoner would collapse and drown in a shallow pool. And Tarquin could claim, "I didn't kill him. He just wasn't strong enough." I took a deep breath. All right. I was a bully. I see that now. I will march right into that box and apologize, and then hope Harpocrates doesn't vaporize me. Raina did not look thrilled. She pushed up her sleeve, revealing a simple black watch on her wrist. She checked the time, perhaps wondering how long it would take to get me vaporized and then get back to camp.
Assuming we can get through those doors, she said. What are we up against? Tell me about Harpocrates.
I tried to summon a mental image of the god.
He usually looks like a child, perhaps 10 years old.
You bullied a 10-year-old? Meg grumbled.
He looks 10. I didn't say he was 10. He has a shaved head, except for a ponytail on one side.
Is that an Egyptian thing? Raina asked.
Yes, for children. Harpocrates was originally an incarnation of the god Horus. Harpa Kruti, Horus the child. Anyway, when Alexander the Great invaded Egypt, the Greeks found all these statues of the god and didn't know what to make of him.
He was usually depicted with his finger to his lips, I demonstrated.
Like, be quiet, Meg said.
That's exactly what the Greeks thought. The gesture had nothing to do with shh. It symbolized the hieroglyph for child. Nevertheless, the Greeks decided he must be the god of silence and secrets. They changed his name to Harpocrates. They built some shrines, started worshiping him, and boom, he's a Greek-Egyptian hybrid god.
Meg snorted.
It can't be that easy to make a new god.
Never underestimate the power of thousands of human minds all believing the same thing. They can remake reality. Sometimes for the better, sometimes not.
Raina peered at the doors.
And now Harpocrates is in there. You think he's powerful enough to cause all our communications failures?
He shouldn't be. I don't understand how...
Those cables, Meg pointed.
They're connecting the box to the tower.
Could they be boosting his signal somehow? Maybe that's why he's up here.
Raina nodded appreciatively.
Meg, next time I need to set up a gaming console, I'm calling you. Maybe we could just cut the cables and not open the box.
I loved that idea, which was a pretty good indication it wouldn't work.
It won't be enough, I decided. The daughter of Bellona has to open the door to the soundless god, right? And for our ritual summoning to work, we need the last breath of the god after his, soul is cut free.
Talking about the Sibylline recipe and the safety of the Praetor's office had been one thing. Talking about it on Sutro Tower, facing the god's big red shipping container, was quite another. I felt a deep sense of unease that had nothing to do with the cold, or the proximity of the sphere of silence, or even the zombie poison circulating in my blood. A few moments ago, I had admitted to bullying Harpocrates. I had decided to apologize.
Then what?
I would kill him for the sake of a prophecy? Another rock plopped into the invisible cage around my head.
Meg must have felt similarly.
She made her best, I don't wanna scowl, and started fidgeting with the tatters of her dress.
We don't really have to, you know, do we? I mean, even if this Harpo guy is working for the Emperors.
I don't think he is.
Raina nodded toward the chains on the locking rods.
It looks like he's being kept in. He's a prisoner.
That's even worse, Meg said.
From where I stood, I could just make out the white stenciled Arabic for Alexandria on the door of the container. I imagined the triumvirate digging up Harpocrates from some buried temple in the Egyptian desert, wrestling him into that box, then shipping him off to America like third-class freight. The emperors would have considered Harpocrates just another dangerous, amusing plaything, like their trained monsters and humanoid lackeys.
And why not let King Tarquin be his custodian?
The emperors could ally themselves with the undead tyrant, at least temporarily, to make their invasion of Camp Jupiter a little easier. They could let Tarquin arrange his cruelest trap for me. Whether I killed Harpocrates or he killed me, what did it matter to the triumvirate in the end? Either way, they would find it entertaining. One more gladiator match to break the monotony of their immortal lives.
Pain flared from the stab wound in my neck. I realized I'd been clenching my jaw in anger. There has to be another way, I said. The prophecy can't mean for us to kill Harpocrates. Let's talk to him. Figure something out. How can we? Raina asked. If he radiates silence? That's a good question, I admitted. First things first, we have to get those doors open. Can you two cut the chains? Meg looked scandalized.
With my swords?
Well, I thought they would work better than your teeth, but you tell me. Guys, said Raina, imperial gold blades hacking away at imperial gold chains? Maybe we could cut through, but we'd be here until nightfall. We don't have that kind of time. I've got another idea. Godly strength. She looked at me. But I don't have any, I protested. You got your archery skills back, she said. You got your musical skills back.
That Valerie song didn't count, Meg said.
Volare, I corrected. The point is, Raina continued, I may be able to boost your strength. I think that might be why I'm here. I thought about the jolt of energy I'd felt when Raina touched my arm. It hadn't been physical attraction or a warning buzz from Venus. I recalled something she had told Frank before we left camp. Bellona's power, I said. It has something to do with strength in numbers? Raina nodded. I can amplify other people's abilities. The bigger the group, the better it works. But even with three people, it might be sufficient to enhance your power enough to rip open those doors.
Would that count? Meg asked. I mean, if Raina doesn't open the door herself, isn't that cheating the prophecy?
Raina shrugged. Prophecies never mean what you think, right? If Apollo is able to open the door thanks to my help, I'm still responsible, wouldn't you say? Besides, I pointed to the horizon. Hours of daylight remained, but the full moon was rising, enormous and white, over the hills of Marin County. Soon enough, it would turn blood red. And so, I feared, would a whole lot of our friends. We're running out of time. If we can cheat, let's cheat. I realized those would make terrible final words. Nevertheless, Raina and Meg followed me into the cold silence. When we reached the doors, Raina took Meg's hand. She turned to me. Ready? Then she planted her other hand on my shoulder. Strength surged through me. I laughed with soundless joy. I felt as potent as I had in the woods at Camp Half-Blood, when I'd tossed one of Nero's barbarian bodyguards into low Earth orbit. Raina's power was awesome. If I could just get her to follow me around the whole time I was mortal, her hand on my shoulder, a chain of 20 or 30 other demigods behind her, I bet there was nothing I couldn't accomplish. I grabbed the uppermost chains and tore them like crepe paper. Then the next set, and the next. The imperial gold broke and crumpled noiselessly in my fists. The steel locking rods felt as soft as breadsticks as I pulled them out of their fittings. That left only the door handles. The power may have gone to my head. I glanced back at Raina and Meg with a self-satisfied smirk, ready to accept their silent adulation. Instead, they looked as if I'd bent them in half, too. Meg swayed, her complexion lima bean green. The skin around Raina's eyes was tight with pain. The veins on her temples stood out like lightning bolts. My energy surge was frying them. Finish it, Raina mouthed. Her eyes added a silent plea. Before we pass out. Humbled and ashamed, I grabbed the door handles. My friends had gotten me this far. If Harpocrates was indeed waiting inside this shipping box, I would make sure the full force of his anger fell on me, not Reyna or Meg. I yanked open the doors and stepped inside. Chapter 29. Ever hear the phrase, "The silence is deafening"? Yeah, that's a real thing. Immediately, I crumpled to my hands and knees under the weight of the other god's power. Silence enfolded me like liquid titanium. The cloying smell of roses was overwhelming. I'd forgotten how Harpocrates communicated, with blasts of mental images, oppressive and devoid of sound. Back when I was a god, I'd found this annoying. Now, as a human, I realized it could pulp my brain. At the moment, he was sending me one continuous message.
You hate.
Behind me, Reyna was on her knees, cupping her ears and screaming mutely. Meg was curled on her side, kicking her legs as if trying to throw off the heaviest of blankets. A moment before, I'd been tearing through metal like it was paper. Now I could barely lift my head to meet Harpocrates' gaze. The god floated cross-legged at the far end of the room. He was still the size of a 10-year-old child, still wearing his ridiculous toga and pharaonic bowling pin crown combo. Like so many confused Ptolemaic gods who couldn't decide if they were Egyptian or Greco-Roman. His braided ponytail snaked down one side of his shaved head, and of course, he still held one finger to his mouth, like the most frustrated, burned-out librarian in the world. Shh. He could not do otherwise. I recalled that Harpocrates required all his willpower to lower his finger from his mouth. As soon as he stopped concentrating, his hand would pop right back into position. In the old days, I had found that hilarious. Now, not so much. The centuries had not been kind to him. His skin was wrinkled and saggy. His once bronze complexion was an unhealthy porcelain color. His sunken eyes smoldered with anger and self-pity. Imperial gold fetters were clamped around Harpocrates' wrists and ankles, connecting him to a web of chains, cords, and cables. Some hooked up to elaborate control panels, others channeled through holes in the walls of the container, leading out to the tower's superstructure. The setup seemed designed to siphon Harpocrates' power and then amplify it, to broadcast his magical silence across the world. This was the source of all our communications troubles. One sad, angry, forgotten little god. It took me a moment to understand why he remained imprisoned. Even drained of his power, a minor deity should have been able to break a few chains. Harpocrates seemed to be alone and unguarded. Then I noticed them. Floating on either side of the god, so entangled in chains that they were hard to distinguish from the general chaos of machinery and wires, were two objects I hadn't seen in centuries. Identical ceremonial axes, each about 4 feet tall, with a crescent blade and a thick bundle of wooden rods fastened around the shaft. Fasces, the ultimate symbol of Roman might. Looking at them made my ribs twist into bows. In the old days, powerful Roman officials never left home without a procession of lictor bodyguards, each carrying one of those bundled axes to let the commoners know somebody important was coming through. The more fasces, the more important the official. In the 20th century, Benito Mussolini revived the symbol when he became Italy's dictator. His ruling philosophy was named after those bundled axes, fascism. But the fasces in front of me were no ordinary standards. These blades were imperial gold. Wrapped around the bundles of rods were silken banners, embroidered with the names of their owners. Enough of the letters were visible that I could guess what they said. On the left, Caesar Marcus Aurelius Commodus Antoninus Augustus. On the right, Gaius Julius Caesar Augustus Germanicus, otherwise known as Caligula. These were the personal fasces of the two emperors, being used to drain Harpocrates' power and keep him enslaved. The god glared at me. He forced painful images into my mind. Me stuffing his head into a toilet on Mount Olympus. Me howling with amusement as I tied his wrists and ankles and shut him in the stables with my fire-breathing horses. Dozens of other encounters I'd completely forgotten about, and in all of them I was as golden, handsome, and powerful as any triumvirate emperor. And just as cruel. My skull throbbed from the pressure of Harpocrates' assault. I felt capillaries bursting in my busted nose, my forehead, my ears. Behind me, Reyna and Meg writhed in agony. Reyna locked eyes with me, blood trickling from her nostrils. She seemed to ask, "Well, genius, what now?" I crawled closer to Harpocrates. Tentatively, using a series of mental pictures, I tried to convey a question. How did you get here? I imagined Caligula and Commodus overpowering him, binding him, forcing him to do their bidding. I imagined Harpocrates floating alone in this dark box for months, years, unable to break free from the power of the fasces, growing weaker and weaker as the emperors used his silence to keep the demigod camps in the dark, cut off from one another, while the triumvirate divided and conquered. Harpocrates was their prisoner, not their ally. Was I right? Harpocrates replied with a withering gust of resentment. I took that to mean both yes and you suck, Apollo. He forced more visions into my mind. I saw Commodus and Caligula standing where I now was, smiling cruelly, taunting him.
You should be on our side, Caligula told him telepathically. You should want to help us.
Harpocrates had refused. Perhaps he couldn't overpower his bullies, but he intended to fight them with every last bit of his soul. That's why he now looked so withered. I sent out a pulse of sympathy and regret. Harpocrates blasted it away with scorn. Just because we both hated the triumvirate did not make us friends. Harpocrates had never forgotten my cruelty. If he hadn't been constrained by the fasces, he would have already blasted me and my friends into a fine mist of atoms. He showed me that image in vivid color.
I could tell he relished thinking about it.
Meg tried to join our telepathic argument. At first, all she could send was a garbled sense of pain and confusion. Then she managed to focus. I saw her father smiling down at her, handing her a rose. For her, the rose was a symbol of love, not secrets. Then I saw her father dead on the steps of Grand Central Station, murdered by Nero. She sent Harpocrates her life story, captured in a few painful snapshots. She knew about monsters. She had been raised by the beast. No matter how much Harpocrates hated me, and Meg agreed that I could be pretty stupid sometimes, we had to work together to stop the triumvirate. Harpocrates shredded her thoughts with rage. How dare she presume to understand his misery? Reyna tried a different approach. She shared her memories of Tarquin's last attack on Camp Jupiter. So many wounded and killed, their bodies dragged off by ghouls to be reanimated as Vrekolakai. She showed Harpocrates her greatest fear. That after all their battles, after centuries of upholding the best traditions of Rome, the 12th Legion might face their end tonight. Harpocrates was unmoved. He bent his will toward me, burying me in hatred.
All right, I pleaded. Kill me if you must, but I am sorry. I have changed. I sent him a flurry of the most horrible, embarrassing failures I'd suffered since becoming mortal. Grieving over the body of Heloise the Griffin at the waystation, holding the dying Pandos crest in my arms in the burning maze, and of course, watching helplessly as Caligula murdered Jason Grace. Just for a moment, Harpocrates's wrath wavered. At the very least, I had managed to surprise him. He had not been expecting regret or shame from me. Those weren't my trademark emotions.
If you let us destroy the Fasces, I thought, that will free you. But we'll also hurt the emperors, yes? I showed him a vision of Rhaena and Meg cutting through the Fasces with their swords, the ceremonial axes exploding. Yes, Harpocrates thought back, adding a brilliant red tint to the vision. I had offered him something he wanted. Rhaena chimed in. She pictured Commodus and Caligula on their knees, groaning in pain. The Fasces were connected to them. They'd taken a great risk leaving their axes here. If the Fasces were destroyed, the emperors might be weakened and vulnerable before the battle.
Yes.